I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Karen Rowell. She's Executive Director of Youth Shelters right here in Santa Fe. And we're also joined by Jesse Workman and Joan Hayden of Youth Shelters. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte, for having us back again.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you all. So, Karen, remind us what Youth Shelters is all about.
Well, Youth Shelters is a nonprofit organization that's been providing service in Santa Fe for, now we're going into our 32nd year, and we provide services to in crisis, runaway, and homeless youth. And our goal, the mission of the organization is to provide unique, life-changing services to that population of kids. Last year we served over 1,000 youth and their families. We serve youth who live out on the street, who come to us in crisis in our shelter, who live in our transitional living program, who come for counseling, and who come for GED and to do community service.
What are the stories of these kids that they end up needing the services of youth shelters?
Well, a lot of the kids that end up in our programs have been thrown out of their homes. They come from chaotic, dysfunctional families. They have been in and out of CYFD care. They're transitioning out of foster care. Kids come into the shelter, and the shelter tends to be a place where it's a diversion to a detention, so we get a lot of kids that maybe are coming out of the detention juvenile justice system and come there because they're not violent or aggressive, so they can live at the shelter and then go back to day reporting during the day. We have kids that are there with CYFD that are in CYFD custody that are waiting for placement in safe and stable housing. And kids that just are referred from the schools. We have kids, the hospitals will send kids to us if they are afraid the child won't be safe at home. And so the shelter provides a safe and stable, well, not stable, but a placement for them to be while we look for a place for them to be safe and stable.
What are some of these homes like that they're being, that either they're not safe or that parents are kicking kids out of them?
Well, they're homes that are economically distressed, homes where there's a lot of addiction and there's a history ongoing of trauma. All of the kids that we serve have extensive trauma history, so we practice trauma-informed services at the agency, realizing that the kids that we're working with are in a constant state of fight or flight, and that we keep that at the forefront of our dealings with them so that not to re-traumatize them and to try to make a connection. It's the connection with positive others, adults, that make the huge difference in all these children's lives.
Well, I'd just like to add that, you know, many of the kids that we serve, especially those who are living out in the streets, who are living in cars, under bridges, camping out, have been thrown out of their homes or have chosen to be, chosen is a charged word, but are on the street because it's safer to be on the street than it is to be at home.
Mm-hmm.
Kids will be locked out of their homes because perhaps they came out as gay or lesbian.
Is there a lot of that?
Yes. 20% of the youth we serve in our street outreach program are on the streets because of that, because when they come out... Or teen pregnancy, if a young woman tells their parents that they're pregnant, it's not unusual for them to find themselves packed up and sent out onto the streets to relatives, to couch surfing. High incidence, I think, from... We've been serving really in a very focused way pregnant and parenting teens for about 5 years, and we went from... in the first year, serving somewhere between 20 and 25, to last year, we actually served 195 youth with their children. So, and it's not that there are more kids necessarily, it's this kids are finding us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, do these young women, for example, ever show up and say, I'm pregnant and I don't want to carry this child to term?
Yes.
Are there services for
mm-hmm.
them?
Mm-hmm. Our job is really... is to help them make those decisions, refer them to appropriate services depending on what their choices are. Basically, what we're trying to do is create safety. So we don't want a mom having a baby out in the woods because they're homeless. We don't want a mom to keep a child because someone is forcing them to do it. And so what we will do is we will make referrals based on the information that we glean together in partnership from the young mom or the mom and the father.
You're talking about trauma and its many manifestations, social manifestations, manifestations of the individual, mm-hmm. Young people. And on the one hand, young people are very resilient, and given half a chance, they can really come back. On the other hand, the traumas that happen to you when you're young are the ones that you're in therapy for 20, 30, 40 years later a lot of the time. How do you help them? I mean, you're the clinical director, Joan Hayden, to go on with their lives in such a way that they actually are able to heal as young people. Is that even possible?
Well, it's possible. It takes, because of the way our programs are set up, especially the outreach center, we don't necessarily maintain contact long enough to really, the trauma that these youth have experienced has been ongoing since they were infants. And so as the brain develops, it changes the structure of the brain, that kind of trauma.
Yeah.
And to actually, you know, reverse that, It requires a lot of very intensive therapy. We don't really try to, that's not our focus. Our focus is to stay more in the present and to develop a relationship with them one-on-one, because there is such healing in that for them to build trust with another individual.
And that probably has its own positive brain structure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And to stay focused on what their needs are right now. You know, housing, food. It's Maslow's hierarchy. We really try to focus on that base level to help these kids gain some security and structure in their lives, so that as they move on, because we're only in their lives for a few years, we only serve up to 22. And so after that, we don't know how much our services really impact them. You know, we hope that those seeds that we've planted will grow in the future. But during the time, we might see, you know, them stabilize a little bit and get into school. And, you know, it's like keeping your fingers crossed and really, you know, hoping that they will continue on that path.
One thing that I would like to add to what Joan just said is that what we do find is that so many kids have never had an experience of a trusting adult. And we, as an organization, that is one of our key goals, is to provide, you know, trusting relationships so that kids can come and lean into us as they grow in towards independence. So, you know, once we are able to provide an experience of support long enough for them to get their kind of sea legs, then they can go off on their own. And having had some experiences of success and knowing where they can go back to if they need additional support is of major importance in the whole development out of the trauma-informed care.
I would think that with the kind of past that they've had, and then here they have adults who are really providing a different model, that before that real trust and love and everything begin to develop, there's a lot of testing, a lot of acting out, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, of course there is. First of all, they're teenagers. So there's going to be acting out, no matter if you're completely, you know, been raised in a very stable, loving environment or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, unlike elementary school kids who never act out.
Oh, of course. But It's interesting. It's I often compare it to lava lamps. You know, it's always moving and changing, and our job is to hold that container while it does that, and to just maintain that.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah, that holding while they go through all that different changes and testing and whatnot.
Jesse Workman, you work with what's called the Civic Justice Corps at youth shelters. What's that?
Mm-hmm. The Civic Justice Corps is a new department labor-funded program, and it's for young people ages 18 to 22 who are coming out of the juvenile justice system. So whether they've been officially adjudicated, whether they've served time in one of the jails in Albuquerque or Santa Fe, or whether they've just gotten in some kind of trouble and have even informal probation, it's a program for that group of young people to work on getting their GED or going to the community college, for them to get job skills, and for them to also, I mean, basically it's a re-entry point back into the community so that they can begin to reconnect.
And so what do you do with them? How do you interact with them?
So we're working on a six-month cycle. So we have a group right now, and they come in the morning, and they're working on their GED, and then in the afternoon they're going...
So you, like, help them with their geometry or things like that? Or?
Yeah, so depending on... We assess where they're at and then start tutoring them individually. At this point, we're working with them individually on wherever their needs are. We're working with the community college, so they're...
They're connected with the community college if they're in our program right away, and we use the TABE test to determine where their deficits are and where their strengths are, and then we move from there to try to address those deficits so that they can take the GED test and complete that. And then we have work sites in the afternoon.
And so then in the afternoon, they're going to a variety of work sites around Santa Fe. They're going to the animal shelter and Earth Care and Kitchen Angels in the city of Santa Fe, and each of those programs have developed a specific program for our youth. And the goal is for them to get a variety of work experience so that in a few months we can begin to set them up with internships and then permanent employment. And the underlying theme of this whole project is restorative justice, the idea that there's a lack of connection. So they've harmed the community that they're coming from, and I think also maybe never really felt connected to that community. And what we're trying to do is be a bridge for them to come back into it and then make meaningful connections so that they can be accountable and not continue to reoffend.
What's it like for them? I would think that there's something particularly healing about working with animals at the animal shelter.
Yeah, I think the animal shelter... The animal shelter has been a really good site, and they've actually had really good experience at all of the work sites so far. I've been really surprised by how much they've enjoyed the city of Santa Fe, and I think that they really focus on teamwork there, and they get, like, whatever the project is, they get to really jump into it and sort of work as a group and then take on, like, even something like building trash cans. They come back and they're almost as excited or more excited about that than they are going to the animal shelter.
Is that right? Why do you think that is? Just having success building something? I mean,
I think that, and I think because they get to really, like, take on their own roles together and make it happen as a team. And I think that's something that they really need.
I think there's something that's very important, which is basically the reality that underneath it all, people really want to be good and want to be in community and want to accomplish stuff, and give them a chance and they will do that and they'll stop offending. And it seems like kind of a natural process.
I think that's really true. And really, you know, in so many times in the past when we've done interviews or we talk about our programs, we really focus on, you know, where these young people come from and their dire circumstances, which is very, very important. But I think also that we have to highlight the great accomplishments. And you talked earlier about resiliency. And that's what I'm so proud of as an organization, is that we're really providing a container in the lava lamp, as Joan talked about, where kids are really having some incredible successes. And I think it's because of, you know, coming to a place that really values that. And, okay, they come from these circumstances, but now somebody's saying, okay, there's an expectation here, and here's an opportunity to do some great stuff. So we have kids who, you know, might have been living under a bridge a year ago and panhandling on the street and, you know, kind of living homeless hand to mouth, who come into our resource center, start by, you know, taking a shower, getting some food, and the next thing they know, they are applying to the community college and getting a scholarship. They have a job. They've moved out from the bridge to an apartment and are now, you know, working full time and, you know, themselves looking back and saying, wow, well, you know, where was I a year ago? And here I am now. A couple of weeks ago, I ran into a young person who actually, when I was working in a program, was homeless, and he lived in our transitional living program, who now has a family. He saved up enough money to buy a house. He graduated from the culinary arts program at the community college and has been on a couple of Food Network TV shows that have featured Santa Fe.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, what a great thing. And that is, it's so satisfying, and it's so important that kids are making great strides and having success.
Do you follow them 5-10 years out?
We don't follow them specifically. We do aftercare. We check in with them 3 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, a year. But sometimes we can't find them, so that makes it difficult.
On the other side, there are a number of kids who I've been in and out of youth shelter since 1995. And so I have the privilege of having worked with a lot of kids and see them around town. And I can't necessarily approach them because of issues of confidentiality. But I see them. I see them working. I see them. And sometimes, you know, one of the most wonderful things that happened to me, this was several years ago, I was pumping gas in my car, and this kid ran up to me, goes, Karen, I have been looking for you everywhere. I have to tell you, I graduated from high school, and now I'm going to college.
Those must be the moments of your life where you go home happy.
Yeah, that makes it all worth it.
When you look at the big picture, these people are existing, these young people whom you care for are existing not only within traumatized families who are themselves traumatized by their own history and economics, but in a political system. I mean, discrimination against gay, lesbian young people, discrimination against pregnant girls, and just the vast economic inequality that for some people passes as normal in this society. There must be at least, I'm not sure what you do in the shelter, but in your minds, a kind of activist element of how you'd like it to be changed, how you'd like the system to be different.
Well, yes.
Yeah. You know, I heard this someone speaking one time and said that teenagers are one of the most demonized groups. Homeless people are demonized. And so when you take an adolescent who is homeless, they are double demonized.
Yeah.
And so when I think about the youth who come through our doors, you know, they have trauma, they have their adolescence, and they're oftentimes homeless. You know, what I wish for in my, you know, very idealized way is, first of all, you know, a social service system that didn't punish people for social justice reasons. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so many times homeless people are looked at in terms of a medical system, a medical model, and they are pathologized as if that was some kind of mental illness. Now, yes, homeless people are oftentimes mentally ill, but with homeless teenagers, you know, they're a lot of that is social justice, and if we had better ways of providing them support and services, and then you peel the whole onion all the way back to where did it start. I mean, if it's really about, you know, teaching people how to be good parents, having good early educational opportunities, having a system where, you know, trauma doesn't start at infancy or in the prenatal stages, so that you have to undo all that stuff as they grow.
And so often we find with our young mothers that they just, because of their own histories, they don't have a clue how to, you know, the idea of a schedule, of nap times, of going to bed at a certain time is like completely off their radar.
Because they never learned that themselves.
They haven't had a role model for parenting.
So a lot of what we do, we have a pregnant and parenting teen coordinator, and she goes in and works with them and starts a discussion about sitting at the table to eat, because a lot of those kids grow up with no table. So they have never had to sit at a table and eat together. So it's like I said, it's not on their radar. And so just start introducing some of those concepts that are very basic to us, to them, are anomaly.
That's the work, yeah. In terms of the piece about teenagers, I'll never forget talking to somebody who was from Latin America, and I said to him, what was your teenage rebellion like? And he said, Mary Charlotte, we don't do that here.
Right.
We love our parents. They love us. We enjoy our time. We live in their house for the rest of our lives a lot of the time. And you Americans make things too hard. You really don't need to do that. And then I start, once he said that, because it blew me away, because I just thought this was a universal. And I started looking at the things adults say, and they are continually conditioning teenagers to be a pain in the neck, saying, oh, well, next year he'll be 13 and God knows what, you know, that kind of thing.
Watch out when they start driving.
I mean, none of this even has to be. And I think it's important for adults, even adults of regular, happy, middle-class children, to kind of be aware of the ways in which they take part in this.
I think, too, it's like how do we as families get separated from each other? You know, and going back to the economy, when you think about, well, it takes, you know, two people in a household to pay the bills. And so, you know, you bring home, you know, you stop by McDonald's and you bring it home because you've worked till 7:30 and the kids, you know, and you don't sit down and eat together because everybody's doing their homework or watching television. And, you know, we're so separated from each other and we're so stressed out. And that's just, you know, that's just a small piece of the puzzle. I think it's also, you know, how teenagers are sometimes treated as a separate group, and they're, you know, they're not incorporated into the responsibility of the family, and, you know, everybody pulls their weight, and, you know, and there's so many pressures of our society that pull at all of us and make teenage years very complicated.
Which with the Civic Justice Corps, that addresses a lot of that about reconnecting in the community and being a group. And so just like you were talking about the city of Santa Fe, I think that's one of the things I love so much is they have to figure out, okay, how are we going to put this trash can together? Who's going to work at this station? Who's going to do this and who's going to do that? And then they do it as a group. And that is something that is, you know, that feeling of connection is what all humans need, right? We all need to.
I think it's empowerment, too, by the response, by the fact that they're given the responsibility to do the job.
Exactly. So they're respected.
Yes.
Their way that they organize it is really held in respect and followed. So, yeah.
And those tools you learn when you're 13 to 18 are things that come very naturally to you when you're older. So you might as well learn to do things and to be responsible for things.
I think the other thing about being a teenager, I think that a lot of times the same exact things that adults go through, the same like struggles and thought processes, teenagers go through the same thing, but it's just not treated as valid. Like,
right. Well, you know, I have an example of that. A friend of mine was a counselor, a high school counselor, and she would see these young people falling in love, and everybody treated it in a trivial way, and they would call it puppy love. But some of these people either stayed together for life or people found each other again 20 years later and got together with their high school sweetheart. And so those bonds are real, and that those emotions are really true.
Right, and as if that's not the same thing that adults are also doing when they're dating. Or I mean, I think that they're going through a lot of the same processes, and if we can acknowledge that and respect that and treat them as if it's just as serious as it is for an adult, I think that really helps them be able to then be empowered and step into what they're actually working on doing. And I think that is something that we're really trying to do in the Civic Justice Corps, is just to be able to, I mean, there are so many different pieces of their lives that they're really trying to get a grasp on. They're stepping into adulthood. So I think that if we can just take each one of those little pieces and start to begin to address it and to respect where they're at and whatever it is that they're working on, then I think they're able to actually move forward. I mean, we've just had a couple of young people so far in this program who have been in homeless or relatively homeless situations and struggled with getting there on time. And I think that, you know, one way to look at that is like, oh, well, this kid's never going to be on time. But then we've been able to set them up in the transitional living program or in some sort of other stable housing, and all of a sudden they're showing up at 8 a.m., you know? Like, I think that as we're able to address those little pieces, or they're not little pieces, big pieces, huge things that they're working on, then they're actually able to move forward and to, like, make some changes. And I think that over time, the potential for that is exponential. I think it just takes acknowledging exactly where they're at and just starting to work on that.
If there are any young people listening, or maybe their teachers or friends, I mean, how do new young people get into the programs that you're talking about?
So if there are any young people age 18 to 22 who have had involvement with the juvenile justice system within the last year, then they can just look at the website. It's www.youthshelters.org. Or they can call the administration building and get more information and come in for an interview. And we're actually, at this point, we're doing open enrollment, so they can come in at any time.
And the phone number is area code 505-983-0586. I want to thank you all very much for being on the program with us. Karen Rowell is executive director, Jesse Workman is with the Civic Justice Corps, and Joan Hayden is the clinical director of Youth Shelters. Once again, youthshelters.org. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the show John Greenspan, Tony Hatch, and Richard Block. And for those of you who've been listening to KSFR for a number of years, these are all names from the history of KSFR from its very beginnings 10 years ago. It's been 10 years this month since KSFR formed as a separate, what is it, John Greenspan? It's a separate foundation that was separate from the Santa Fe Community College.
That's correct. The station license is held by the Santa Fe Community College, but we formed a corporation. Actually, the corporation was in existence, but we kind of hooked up with it and filed a proposal to manage the station for the college when there was a time where the college wanted to actually sell the station to somebody else, and we said we should keep the station. So that's how all this came about.
So let's talk about each of your involvement. Tony Hatch, you were the first news director of KSFR, and I remember it was about 10 years ago, and I heard that KSFR, I guess I knew somebody who was involved with the station, and I heard that KSFR was in a state of change. I was already DJing a music show on the weekends, but I heard that they were starting a news department, and I went to the very first news class that you taught. And you brought recordings of old-time radio news, including the crash of the Hindenburg.
Hindenburg, yes, which Richard corrected me on years ago when we were doing a promotion. I had misspelled the Hindenburg. Yes, that class, it's hard to believe it's 10 years ago. And you look lovely 10 years later. I can't speak for the other men sitting around this table, but it's hard to believe it's 10 years ago. Yes, we started a news department, and it was started because of the sense that the public was not well served here in Santa Fe by the Albuquerque stations. I still think that's the perception or the reality.
Well, of course, you know, these two cities are, even though they're only an hour apart, they're very far apart. And so people covering news in Santa Fe aren't covering Albuquerque as much and pretty much vice versa.
That's right.
So what was, John, what was KSFR like at that time 10 years ago? I was listening to you made a brief history of KSFR, a little CD, and something I didn't know was that broadcast day started at 9 a.m.?
That's correct. It was on automation during the evening hours, and then we actually got started with jazz at 9 a.m. And as far as news, it was rip and read, as they call it in the business, and we would get some stuff over the AP wire or whatever, And I remember with Donna DiBianco, sometimes we would take about 5 to 7 minutes and read some news stories, and that was it. But I agreed with Tony when we eventually got to know each other that we needed some real local news here. We needed a hefty news department. It was something lacking in the community.
And so, Tony, how did you actually get a news department started? I mean, basically, you were training volunteer reporters, some of whom had never done any kind of news reporting or reading before.
Well, I had done something very similar to that years before in Israel, helping to start Israel Television Service, starting a news service, and dealing with people who either were not journalists or they were radio journalists. So it was the same thing, and that class was really intended to try to find people like yourself who were interested in radio and doing radio. And we then threw them on the air, as a matter of fact, and we got on the air very rapidly with the news department.
And next thing you know, KSFR is winning every year the AP Awards.
Yeah, well, that's because it has a very good news director, and we were lucky. He came in those early classes, but he, as a matter of fact, didn't really need the knowledge about how to do news programs because he had come from that background.
And, of course, we're talking about the fabulous Bill Dupuy.
Yes, Bill Dupuy.
But you were news director first.
Yes, yes, but it was really a startup operation, and it was to get on the air. And I remember we did a very ambitious series called Water Week. There were unique reports about the water situation in the Southwest every hour on the hour. We did 72 installments, I believe, with people, some people who had never done this before. And it was trying to kickstart this operation, this news operation, and get it going.
I remember that, and it was very good, and it was very interesting. Now, how did the BBC get added? Were you there at that time?
Yes, I was, and I suggested that we try to get the BBC. Other stations in this listening area were getting National Public Radio. BBC was not carried here, and it seemed to me a good value added. What's the word I'm looking for? Trying to get something into the mix of local radio here that this audience in Santa Fe would appreciate.
Now, NPR wanted to get us as part of the family, and I talked to them about that. But my feeling was, besides the fact it was very expensive, that we would simply be duplicating what there already was. There's plenty of Morning Edition that's on several stations mm-hmm. around here, and I thought that by doing BBC News, we'd get some diversity, and people could have a choice, and maybe you like the story BBC is covering, maybe the one Morning Edition is covering, but the point is, you would have a choice.
You know, also at that time, I think in order to get BBC, we joined PRI, or Public Radio International, which carried that. But the other kind of reservation about NPR is that if you're an NPR station, you do have to obey a lot of their rules on fundraising, on all kinds of things. And it curtailed our freedom, and of course, we needed to raise more money. At the time, we were one of the parts of the agreement with the community college was that not only would we manage it, but we were also responsible for financing it entirely.
That was an amazing moment. KSFR had existed before 10 years ago. It existed for some time, but they were a line item in the community college's budget. And one day, the president of the community college just slashed all non-academic programs overnight. So the station went from being, I think, $250,000 budget to zero in a day.
And for that first year, at least, the board met every single week.
That's correct.
And the subject was, where are we going to get the money to continue on next week and the week after?
That's correct. And the station had never done on-air fund drives, and the first one we did was in December of 2000, and we sat there for about a week and raised $12,000. What we've had to do is to educate the public that you support your local public radio station. That's the way it is, and I think Santa fans have gotten the message.
We're talking about the history of KSFR. I have to say, another thing behind the BBC was around the time that we were deciding, and I was
first a volunteer and then a part-time behind-the-scenes engineer. So I was watching everything that was going on. But part of what was going on was that it was the build-up to the invasion of Iraq. And there were a lot of people who were listening to NPR and begging us to have something else on that gave a point of view about this impending invasion that was something other than essentially cheerleading for the U.S. government. And that was one of the things that led to the decision to bring in the BBC.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, John just said that first fund drive. One of the requirements if you're an NPR station is they do these fund drives and they're 1 week. And I learned fundraising on the air from Alan Chartok at WAMC in Albany, and he is a phenomenon.
He's the best in the business.
He's a phenomenon, and we're friends, and he taught me a lot about this. And it seemed to me that how much money we need, and we stay on the air till we get it. And then the next drive, we got 52,000, and then it went to 100. And of course, the budget of the station grew all along. But we went on the air and we stayed. The first time I remember, we were on for 17 days.
I remember that one, and you and I were there a lot of the time.
Richard Block, I remember you were there in your little flip-flops.
From 6 in the morning till 7 at night.
And you were going completely bananas yourself and driving all the rest of us crazy as well.
Block was the mainstay.
But we raised the money.
We raised the money.
That's the point. And you know, we did all kinds of things to do it, you know, but it's just a little, you know, I guess a little bit of P.T. Barnum thrown in.
So the station has evolved in a number of ways. One was that the news went from being non-existent to being really first-rate local news, and then with this international news of the BBC thrown in, there was also a consolidation and a change in the way programming was done. So certain kinds of programs went on the weekends that had been scattered all over the broadcast day. There was always jazz in the morning, classical in the afternoon, and then there was a decision which was quite controversial to change class to basically take out classical in the afternoon and put jazz all day. What was that about?
Well, what happened was that you have KHFM in Albuquerque, which puts a signal in Santa Fe. In fact, they identify themselves as Santa Fe Albuquerque, and they were very popular among people who like classical music. And most people, when they turn on the radio, leave it on one station all day. Now, there are a few of us that are all over the place, but that is not typical. And we were getting, ratings, and we simply could not cut into their audience on classical music. Now, at the time, I did not know that we were going to be able to change frequencies and go from 90.7 to 101.1. And we had tried to get translators to increase our coverage, but we ran into a problem with the FCC. Whatever happened, we were always down low on the preference list. But eventually we did get to 101.1 and increased our signal, but we simply weren't attracting much of an audience for classical music at that time. So we had to make the decision. And, of course, we do have classical music Sunday afternoon. We had opera on Tuesday evenings. But, you know, it was just one of those things. We couldn't pull in the audience.
Even though our classical music programs played entire works, unlike KHFM that does pieces.
That's true.
One movement of something.
Yeah, and we had some wonderful classical DJs. The amazing Kit Blackwood, who I remember she was always having trouble actually controlling the the CD players, but the music that she played
good
was
music.
Wonderful. Yeah. She had such great taste, and so did many of the other classical DJs.
Yeah, I used to play complete Mahler symphonies, you know, in the afternoon. I really enjoyed doing that, but as I said, we just couldn't get, we had Arbitron ratings, and we just couldn't cut into them at that time. So that's what happened.
Now, all of you were at one time or another on the board of KSFR, and the board hired general manager at that time, Dal Dierman, who was with the station for many years. And I want to send a some kudos out to him because he really grew this station from nothing into the station that it is today.
He did a great job, really. John was the first president of the board, and then I followed him as president. But Dal and I worked as partners for 2 or 3 years, pretty much. And he really did help this station. I mean, you know, to think now of KSFR and compare to what KSFR represented 10 years ago, when, you know, very few people even heard of us. And then slowly we became involved. Dal and I both schmoozed the city council a lot, got the city council involved, got the city to contribute annually here.
And it brought this amazing thing, which was the broadcast of the city council meetings, which most cities don't have. And it's a huge service to the, I mean, not everybody listens to it, and sometimes it's not the kind of radio you want to listen to, but a lot of the time I'm driving along listening to that, and it's democracy in action. You get to hear what your city council is doing.
And Richard, you know, you and I went to the legislature, too, to get funding from them.
We did indeed.
So, well, I have to tell the story about the mysterious check, if that's okay.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, yes. That was early on.
Yes.
Yeah.
This was early. This is when we're meeting every week. We don't know if we're going to make payroll the next, or what little payroll we had. And we're in our office there, which all of us shared. And I open up an envelope.
Which was the size of a closet, by the way.
And still is.
Yeah. And you know, we open up this one envelope, no return address on it, and there's a check inside that falls out, and it was for like $22,300-some and some odd cents. The signature was illegible. There was a note inside, good luck, I hope you guys make it. The check was drawn on the Foundation for Urban Research, which is a 501c3. It's based in Philadelphia. Dal ran to the bank, put the check in. I mean, he just took off, and the check cleared. We sent a thank you note to this organization in Philadelphia. We never heard back.
No.
We don't know how we got this or who, what, why, where, but it happened. And in those days, that was about two to two and a half months of our operating expenses. And when that happened, I said, I think we're destined to make it.
Yeah, and if whoever is responsible for that is listening now, we want to say once again, thank you.
Thank you. It was amazing. I mean, it was so scrawled, you couldn't read it, and there was no identification on it. And, of course, the first thing we thought is, oh, of course, it's no good. But it was.
So another big milestone for KSFR was when we started streaming on the web and having a website. That was, for us, I mean, I guess everybody started doing it at the time or a little before, but that made us brought us from being a local to a national station.
Absolutely did, and we have heard people from people around the world, from Glasgow, people in Israel, New Zealand.
I got an email from Jakarta the other day.
Wow, amazing!
Just a random person who discovered this show.
And yeah. During the fund drives, after we had this set up, we got contributions, as I recall, from Scotland, from England, and Austria, I think, one time we got a contribution. So it's remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, you have to stream these days. That's, you know, that's the way it is. People are all over the place. But, yeah, we certainly joined the 21st century.
What's also amazing is, when you think about it, 10 years back, we didn't have... You didn't have the internet as it is today. You didn't have social networking. You didn't have the technology, the platforms that you do. It was really when we changed KSFR. It was in the early days of communications as it is today. If I'm making any sense in that, these things didn't exist.
One of the things that I think is also worth mentioning and worth really commenting on is there's been some continuities through all these years, and that is the music shows that are on in the evenings. Susan O'Hori has been here forever. Acoustic Explorations has been here. Peter Williams with his amazing Thursday night show. Mark Keekley, the Invisible Man, doing Map Is Not Territory, has been here for ages.
Yeah, I brought him on, by the way, and I just loved his ideas, too. Mark has done a great job.
And Terrell, of course.
Oh, yes. Steve Terrell's an institution here.
Yeah, so many people. I'm not mentioning them all because I'm not looking at the program schedule, but the one of the things that people don't know, perhaps who are listening during drive time, is the music shows and the shows that are happening at night are done by people who are really, really knowledgeable and obsessed with the kind of music that they play. And obsession is one of those qualities that I love about public radio.
You have to be.
Yeah. Also, let me just add a couple of things here. One of the things that helped save the station were all the wonderful people who came out of the woodwork to help out. Of course, Tony was one of those. We were in it from the very beginning. And Mary Charlotte, I also want to just mention that after we had got started, one day I was doing my afternoon classical show, and Dorothy Doyle, who should also be mentioned, who really rolled up her sleeves and did a lot of great work, brought you into the studio, introduced me to you, and I just thought, I think this person's going to be special. The rest is history. Of course, Richard, you sent me a letter. You wanted to be on the board, and your resume looked good, and of course you just did so much for the station. And Tony, I felt you were kind of a mentor to me, particularly as we did have to deal with some personnel issues when we took over, and you helped me get through that and explain how things work in the real world. I came from the government, so anyway, I'll just leave it at that.
Well, all of you have made a tremendous contribution to KSFR. Tony Hatch, the original news director and the founder of KSFR News, local news. John Greenspan, one of the original board members and board presidents, and still you are doing Good Morning Jazz. When are you on the radio, John?
All right, we have Good Morning Jazz on Wednesday and Thursday mornings, 9 to noon, and we have the Forum on Tuesday evenings at 6:30, where we have a liberal, a moderate, and a conservative. We discuss issues, and we prove that you can disagree with each other and not scream at everyone or be disrespectful. It can be done.
That's a beautiful thing. And you're also DJing on KHFM in Albuquerque. And Richard Block, also on the board for years here at KSFR, board president for a while, and the voice of the fun drive many years.
You know, I would stand in line at the grocery or at Smith's or something, and when I'd speak, and someone behind me would say, "Do I know you?" And I said, "Do you ever listen to KSFR?" Yeah. I said, "Well, I'm the one who's always exhorting you for money." And
and then saying things like, "Would you go use your neighbor's washing machine?"
That's right. Would you borrow your neighbor's hose? Oh,
yeah. Would that help? Yeah.
And I do, just to correct Tony, John and I are still lovely also.
Yes.
Well, I don't know about that.
On reflection, yes.
What's remarkable is everybody looks exactly the same as they always did. Well, I want to thank you.
I don't have as much hair.
Well, yeah, but, you cut it short. So I want to thank you all for being with us on the Radio Cafe and for your contributions to KSFR over the years. And I want to thank all of our listeners for sticking with us during the hard times and growing with us. And it's a terrific station, and I'm really proud to be part of it.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.